So we had said that the basis for good traits is truthfulness, is humility, and the basis for humility is truthfulness, and the basis of bad traits is haughtiness, and the basis of haughtiness is lack of truthfulness. And the more truthful a person is, the more he's going to recognize that there's very little that he could take credit for, and quite the contrary, he'll recognize his shortcomings and how much more he should be, and then that'll bring him to humility. The fact that a person accomplishes things doesn't mean that he's humble. It doesn't mean he has good traits. We know that the greatest prophet was Moshe Rabbeinu. He made it to the top. And what trait does the Torah stress he had? He was the greatest honor. How could he be so humble if he's the greatest prophet? He wakes up in the morning and he knows, the whole Torah is me. What God tells me, what I write down, that's what people are going to be studying to the end of time. God's world to the world comes through me. I am God's gift to mankind. Moshe Rabbeinu doesn't say that. Quite the contrary. Moshe Rabbeinu is the most humble of men. Because if a person recognizes that he is just a vessel, he is the vessel that's giving things over, so then even if he's Moshe Rabbeinu, he's not going to be proud. Obviously this takes work. This takes truthfulness. Yeah, but if you recognize that you're a vessel, so you're a vessel. And
a very important vessel.
Okay, but at the end of the day, a vessel. And when a person recognizes that he's a vessel to serve the Creator, so then...
A very important vessel to serve the Creator.
Even if he's a very important vessel to serve the Creator, he's not going to be proud. He's a... So that brings us to another point, that a person's pride is also an element of a person's not recognizing God. If a person recognized God and recognized that what God is to the world and God's how much God gives to the world and how much every breath and every second that we sense and everything we have is God-given, so then a person recognizes how much God is giving to the world as opposed to how much he's giving to the world. And he recognizes he doesn't come close. Part of what happens when a person gets haughty is that he's thinking of himself. And the second the person sees himself in the mirror, then he's not seeing God. The Shulchan Aruch begins with the fact that a person's focus should be Sheviti Hashem l'negdi tamid. I have Hashem upset my eyes. If I have Hashem upset my eyes and that's defining how I function in this world, that's also going to define how I feel about myself. And that means that when I wake up in the morning, I'm going to ask, okay, is Hashem happy with me today or not? How am I doing? And there's no person who could say, yeah, Hashem's thrilled, I'm doing great. Even Moshe Rabbeinu would wake up in the morning and say, I have to fix A, I have to fix B. I'm not a perfect person yet. He's Moshe Rabbeinu, who's far more perfect than we can perceive, but he still has what to work on. So Korach is coming with the exact opposite. He's coming for a machlokas that's not l'shem shemayim. Korach is coming with a machlokas that's going to be presented as though he wants to serve God. It's going to be presented as though all he wants is to be a better Jew. All he wants is to come close. Why is he being kept away? He wants to serve God. Why aren't they letting him be the high priest?
And
let's get to that in a minute. Our sages and the Torah revealed to us that Korach's underlying thoughts were not pure. And Korach wanted to take the leadership. What does Moshe tell them? Rav lachem. It's enough for you, sons of Levi. You have enough. What does Moshe get answered? Rav lach. You've taken enough. Our sages say that when one is in an argument, so then one gets measured. You want to see which person comes from a better family? Watch him when he's having an argument with someone. See how quick he is to concede. When a person is willing to give in quicker, that shows he has better traits. He's from a better family. He's from better stock, the fact that he's willing to give in sooner. If he doesn't stop fighting, that shows he's from lesser stock. Our sages say that even this that Moshe Rabbeinu said, Rav Lachem, you have so much, sons of Levi, God took him to task on that. God said, yeah, you had to answer that, but you didn't have to add that point. There's every word we say and every gesture we make and the countenance with which we say things is measured. People sometimes say, what did I do wrong? What did I say? Sometimes it's how you say it. It's not what you say. Like we discussed last week in the laws of Kibbutz Avein. Sometimes a person can tell his father, Dad, I need you to work. And he could put his father to hard labor. But if his intention is to save his father from worse things, and he presents it to his father kindly in a way that his father takes it well, so then he's performing Kibbutz Avein. Sometimes a person can feed his father the greatest food in the world, and he does it with a countenance that's, he has a scowl on his face. So even though he's doing everything on the books, serving his father, the fact that he's doing it with a bad attitude, that makes it that he's not performing Kibbutz Avein. He'll be punished for it. So over here, God, like our tradition says, God is medakdek with the tzaddikim kechuta sa'ara. With tzaddikim, Hashem watches to the hair width. If they're off on a hair width, then they're taken to task. And Moshe Rabbeinu tells Korach and his men, Rav Lach, you have enough greatness. That was a slight step too far. He automatically gets it back in his face. He gets told, Rav Lach, you've taken enough greatness, Moshe.
He was told in the first.
Yeah, but the Medrash seems to say that even though the order seems right. The order seems to be out of order, but our sages say that the Rav Lach, he told them, you guys have enough. So when he was praying to enter the land of Israel, so Hashem told him, stop praying. With which term did Hashem tell him, stop praying? Parshas Vayeschanan says, V'etchanan l'Hashem v'et ha'i l'mo. Hashem Elokim, ata achilot al arot et avdecha, et godlecha v'et yadcha chazaka, asher miel b'shamayim v'art, asher yasech ma'asech uruchu gvurotecha. You showed me all your greatness. Ebrana, let me cross over. Please, Hashem, let me enter the Holy Land. Layomer Hashem, now Hashem tells me, what does Hashem answer him? Rav Lach. Enough, Moshe. With which words did Hashem answer him? Rav Lach. The same words. He said, enough greatness, enough. So Hashem, he got those words back. When he was asking for the greatest thing, he just wanted to enter the land of Israel. The one request God doesn't grant him, God does it with the same terminology he used for Korach and his men here. Korach and his men come with righteous claims. We want to come close. We want to serve Hashem better. And beneath the surface, really, that's not what they're asking for. There are three people who walk in. Dasan, Aviram, and a man by the name of Nemuel. In the Torah over here, he's called On ben Pelet. Our sages say that really that was Nemuel. There were three brothers, Dasan, Aviram, and Nemuel. They were all the sons of Eliyav. And Dasan and Aviram we've encountered before. But Nemuel we haven't encountered before. Now he gets swept in. But he's called On ben Pelet because ultimately he ended up like in Onen. He was weeping. He was sorrowful for having joined them. And he was Pelet. He was Liflot. He escaped. He narrowly escaped. He didn't end up joining them. Yeah. So it depends on what we're referring to. Much of what our sages say.
That makes a lot of sense. But that's what it says in the text. I mean, it's a really kind of a stretch in order to make put that all in because those words aren't. Okay, I understand you're drawing from Midrash or Gemara, but are they? That's a question.
So when I say our sages say, usually it's because I don't want to toil the listener with the details. Is it Rashi, Ramban, Chizkuni, Seforno, Gemara, Mishnah, Midrash? I use a general term just to discern between what's written in the text so that you yourselves will walk away and remember, this is what's written and this is what our sages said. Because of the point you're raising, that a lot of it isn't written in the text. And if you'll encounter someone that says differently, you should recognize that he's not going against what says in the Torah, he's going against an added understanding that our sages gave us. Now, let's discern between what's in the Gemara and in the Medrash and what's in the Rishonim. What's written? So the Rishonim worked on understanding the text from the words. The Rishonim...
Sometimes, like, in order to understand the text, a lot of information is filled in that I don't see in the text.
So that, we have to learn together. That we have to...
Another source or another
It depends. A lot of what Rashi quotes and the Ramban quotes are Midrashim. They're quoting from our sages and they're getting it from tradition. A lot of what the Rashbam, for example, will quote, Rav Saadia Gaon, the Ibn Ezra, the Sephorno, the Chizkuni, a lot of what they're going to quote is going to be a breakdown of the words, looking from the terminology. If you want to see someone who explains to you why each word means what, you can open up a Malbim on anything in Tanakh, and the Malbim shows you how words that seem so similar, in modern Hebrew we'd even quantify them as the same, as one defining the other, he'd show you that there's a big difference between them, and each one has a specific meaning. And sometimes the breakdown of words, like we discussed a few weeks ago, we have the term Vayishak, gave a kiss. We have Vayishak et, Vayishak le. And the Malbim, based on the Ibn Ezra, defines that there's a very big difference between Vayishak et or Vayishak le. One is a kiss that was given in a manner that showed closeness, and the other one was a kiss that was more like a handshake, it showed a distance. So when King David's son returns, and he begs to be accepted back to the home after he murdered his brother, so it says, Vayishak HaMelech le'Avshalom, the king kissed to Avshalom. So you read the text, on the surface it seems like, oh, he took him back in, he gave him a kiss. Comes the Malbim and says, no, he was showing him, I'm not taking you back all the way. It says he gave a kiss to Avshalom, it doesn't say he kissed Avshalom. His son comes back and he gives him a kiss that shows him, son, maintain a distance, I'm not taking you back all the way yet. So if you don't read all of the Malbim and understand where he's getting it from, you say, hey, it seems to say the exact opposite. So a lot of things.
And anyway, I didn't say I'm reading the English translation, so that's probably also due to the fact.
You need, right. That's why someone was mentioning earlier tonight that why are we spending so much time studying Hebrew? I think the greatest asset you have is studying the language. It's like learning to type. In the beginning, goes slower. If you'd look at the keys, you'd do much quicker. But it's a long-term investment. If you get it, then you'll be able to know a lot more and learn a lot more and a lot quicker and a lot more in depth.
That is a good investment, like
100%. I'll tell you more than that. Guys who go to other yeshivas and come here and talk English. I'll give you two examples. We have guys coming to Israel all the time. And some come from very good, what they call black hat yeshivas in the United States. And some come from what's called very modern Kipas Ruga, places that Gemara was a subject like biology. They learned 45 minutes Gemara, end of the day, that's it. They did their Judaism for the day. But a lot of these places, they learn Hebrew. They teach the guys Hebrew. So you think the guys who are coming in here, they learned in the place that they learned 10, 12 hours a day Gemara and Chumash and Rashi, that they'll be on top. But at the end of a year or 2 years, very often you find the guys who came here with very, very little knowledge, but they knew the language, they go way ahead of the guys who come here with all their knowledge that they've gained. They've learned a lot of Gemara and Mishnah and Chumash, and they have a lot of basics. So they have a lot of knowledge, but the amount that they've proceeded, the other guys overtake them much quicker. And they get much better. They do much better, they get much further. You have guys leaving this country after they've spent 2 years here, not knowing how to learn a piece of Gemara. They can't read a Gemara. They can't read Rashi. I sat next to the guys in Beis Medrash. I was talking to them. They don't know the language. So it's very nice that they could say all kinds of things that they have, that they've learned already. But for them to broaden their knowledge, they're never going to be able to finish us. Until they learn the language, they're not going to be able to learn everything. They could barely learn Chumash.
The language of Hebrew, but what about Aramaic?
It's similar enough that there it's a matter of once you know Hebrew, so you'll catch on to Aramaic. Slowly, but you catch on. That's why I definitely think it's a good investment to know the language, for sure.
In elementary stage,
so that there are long discussions about how to educate kids who are learning another language. That's a different question. In general, the language is one of the greatest assets you could give a person, in my opinion. Whether you should teach kids in Hebrew or in English in Chutz Laaretz, that's a complicated question. So there's always the question, are you going to be here long-term or short-term? And if a person comes here for a month, so then to put in 5 hours a day of Olpan, the question is, what's he going to get out of that after a month?
What about a year?
If a person's coming here for a year, so it seems like guys get a lot out of it. It seems like if guys are willing to put in the time, then they walk away with a lot. And
it's worth it for the fact that you're learning, that you're missing a lot of learning of Mishmara.
This is a very individualistic question. Each person should speak to someone who knows him enough. And I'll tell you the truth. I don't have enough experience with the Ulpan to answer that, to tell you after a year, well, you have gained enough to have made it worthwhile. It seems to be that yes, but I'm not sure about that. I think that that's a question Rav Lisman could probably answer better. He's seen more guys go through it. I don't know what guys get after a year. I know that guys who stay 3 years walk away and they could learn a lot. 1 year, I don't know. I don't know. It seems like that it is a worthwhile investment, but I ask Rav Lisman. It's too serious a question to go by assumption. Like I told the other guy, experiments are good when you're doing something in a laboratory. This is your life. You're putting in time here. You want to get the most out of it. So I wouldn't experiment. I would talk to someone who has experience, and I don't have enough experience, and see what makes sense. So back to our parsha. We have 250 men. Our sages say these 250 were heads of Sanhedrin. Our sages say that Korach came with late sanut. Korach came joking. Whenever a person walks in with late sanut, you have to be careful. Stay away from late sanut.
Joking,
yeah. People who enter things and try to prove a point by being sarcastic or by joking, you have to watch out for. In the Rambam, we have a commentary called the Ravid. Rabbi Avram Av Bezdin. And he attacks the Rambam. And sometimes his attacks are very, very strong. Sometimes he'll say, whoever writes that doesn't know what he's talking about. Whoever writes that didn't learn a word of Gemara, or I'm exaggerating, but he uses very, very harsh terms. The Rambam was writing this when he was tired, when he wasn't focused. He could write all kinds of terms against the Rambam. And the tradition I have is that whenever the Ravid uses very, very harsh terms, it's to cover up because he didn't have a stronger argument. If he had a stronger argument from the Gemara, then he used it from the Gemara. And when he didn't have a strong argument from the Gemara, but he wanted the reader to know that there's a very valid opinion other than the Rambam's opinion, so he couldn't back it up from the Gemara, so he had to use other terms to say, no, the Rambam didn't know what he was talking about when he wrote this. There's another pshat. When he has strong arguments, then he brings it with strong arguments. Korach is coming against Moshe, he's saying, you're telling us that the tzitzis has to have one blue string to represent the fact that blue is a color of royalty and we're the kings, God's servants, we have a blue string. So if you wear a garment that's all blue, do you still need that blue string? So Moshe said, yeah. So he said, what do you mean? That's ridiculous. If one blue string makes it that we're like the king's servants, so certainly if the whole garment is like the king's servants wear, that's enough. So Moshe said, yeah, but that's not the halacha. You have a room. You enter it, God's supposed to be there at the entrance. You have a mezuzah with two parshas in it. What happens if the whole room is filled with sperm? So you're going to still tell me I have to have a mezuzah on doors? Moshe said, yeah, that's the halacha. So Korach made fun.
How come Beth Knesset don't all have
mezuzah? Because it's not a place of living. Mezuzah is for a place where people live. Beth Knesset, if you have people living there...
People have like businesses and it's just...
Let's discuss that in our class on mezuzah. I don't know if we'll get to it tomorrow or next week. We're supposed to have a class on laws of mezuzah.
He means the levity that is covered in Rav Chaim Zadok also. He says you got to watch out for the levity. But not levity in the sense of simcha.
Oh, there's them. It's very good. So in Hebrew we have a difference between simcha and tzchok. Tzchok is to make fun, to have jokes. Simcha is happiness. A person is supposed to have simcha. God does not appear to a person unless he has simcha. One is not supposed to enter prayer unless he has simcha. A person is supposed to live with simcha, and when he does spiritual things, he's supposed to have extra simcha. On a holiday, on a Yom Tov, you're supposed to drink wine, you're supposed to have simcha. On Shabbos, you're supposed to have simcha. Person is supposed to be sameach all year long, and on special holy occasions he's supposed to be more sameach. We're expecting a person to be sameach, but simcha is happiness, which stems from inner tranquility. Tzchok is making fun, which stems from lack of inner peace. You should always be careful when a person is cynical. The greatest jokers, what's his name? There's that black comedian.
Pryor?
Right. There's Richard Pryor and there's the other one.
Eddie Murphy.
You guys know how many psychiatrists he's been to? How many times he tried committing suicide? When a person spends his life making fun of the external world, you have to check for, is he sound? And more often than not, he isn't. I had a guy who asked me, he was considering becoming a medical clown. They have these clowns that come to hospitals to make people happy. So I told him that, obviously there's what to consider, but I said, one thing you have to first consider is, how are you doing psychologically? Why are you considering such a job? Where is it coming from? Are you stable? Where are you holding? Why is it that you want to spend a good part of your day making fun of things? If you're sound and you just want to make sick people happy, okay, very good. The question is, can you stay sound for a long time this way? So that's things you have to talk to people in the profession. I don't know. But you first have to ask yourself, why are you doing it? And this is something that we see in the parasha also. Doesn't in Aviram don't show up often in Tanakh. Moshe Rabbeinu is walking the streets in Egypt and he sees two Jews fighting. And he tells the Rasha, stop, don't hit your friend, you Rasha. And he says, well, you're going to kill me like you killed the Egyptian yesterday? I'll go tell Paro. We have a tradition that was Dasan and Aviram fighting, these two brothers. It doesn't say it in the Torah. It says two Ivri men. We have a tradition that when the man came down, God said, eat it up and tomorrow you'll get more. You have to have faith that tomorrow you'll get more. There were people who left over till tomorrow. There were people who left over. They didn't have faith. They didn't keep the mitzvah. And it got all wormy. God got upset. Who are those people? We have a tradition. It was Dasan and Aviram. It doesn't say their name there. It says two men. There were people who left over. Came the Sabbath. Came Shabbos. God says, don't go out to collect man. It's not going to fall on Shabbos. On Friday, I'll give you double portion. Don't go out to collect on Shabbos. The Torah says there were people who went out to collect on Shabbos. They said, who says? Maybe it's a natural phenomenon that man comes down. And on Shabbos, it will also come. God's telling us it won't come down. They went out to collect. Doesn't say who it was. We have a tradition. It's Dasan and Aviram. So time and again we have trouble. You ask the average kid in yeshiva and he'll tell you, Dasan and Aviram, they show up all over the Torah. Our tradition is that they do. But really over here we see their name. They don't show up by name in any of these instances. So, Dasan and Aviram can have logical claims for a lot of what they're doing. I wanted to believe better. I wanted to make sure it wasn't really coming down on Shabbos. I'm not going to leave over any food for tomorrow. I'm going to go hungry with my family. He hit me first. You could always have claims. And over here, what are they saying? I want to come close to. I want to serve God as a priest. A person has to check himself and see where is he showing up. How many times is he involved in fights? A person can feel like he's the most zealous. He's the one that's protecting God's name in the world. And he could fool himself. But a person has to see how often is he fighting fights. How often is he there at the front lines? I have a tradition from my father. When there are arguments and there are fights, walk away. We had in our shul once, they wanted to make a youth minion. So they said, look, the minion has a lot of older people. If we make a youth minion, we'll get the youth involved. We'll get the youth to stay. They had 100 reasons why they should do it. The older people got very upset about it. So they said, well, now we're going to have a minion just for old people. Have the young people involved here. We'll gladly let them have all the honors they want. What do you have to have a separate minion for? No, if you make a youth minion, they'll feel lively, they'll feel like it's the youth, and we'll draw the crowds. So there was a fight. So my father said, we're leaving. We're not staying here. Where there's a fight, they tried to get us to join. We were all young. My father said, you're not joining. Where there's a fight, you don't join. You walk away. Don't join a fight. Even though they have claims like it's for good sake, you'll get more people to pray, etc. There's a fight, don't be involved. And after half a year, it became very clear what the agendas were. Everyone had reasons to back up what they were saying, but no one had intents that were for the sake of God's name. There was a synagogue in our neighborhood that had a rabbi. He was a very busy rabbi. The congregation came and said, look, we value you, you're a big rabbi, but we need a rabbi who could give more classes. So we're asking you to resign, we're going to hire a different rabbi who could give more classes. A lot of the people joined the fight. They said, it's legitimate. There'll be more classes. There'll be more Torah learning. Half a year later, it became very clear why these arguments went on. The next rabbi was asked to resign, and then the next rabbi was asked to resign. Three rabbis in a row, the congregation had reasons, legitimate reasons, why they need to find a new rabbi. So, very often people present their claims with seeming legitimacy, with God-fearingness. Korach also had claims. Korach said, I want to come close. Everyone's holy. And our tradition is that it was a cover-up. So unlike a lot of people have claims, before a person joins a fight, he has to check very, very well. And when Shabtai Tzvi came on the scene, so Shabtai Tzvi had legitimate claims. Shabtai Tzvi said, why aren't you doing Birchas Kohanim in Chutz Haaretz? What's the source? So he's not the first person to mention that claim. The Shulchan Aruch also was wondering why they're not doing Birchas Kohanim in Chutz Haaretz. Why don't the Kohanim bless every day? And the Rama was also wondering why they don't do it in Chutz Haaretz. And you find throughout the generations people are wondering. The Gra was also wondering why they don't do it in Chutz Haaretz. But Shabtai Tzvi said, we're going to start doing it in Chutz Haaretz. And that was one of his claims. Many of the rabbis were wondering, should we join Shabtai Tzvi or not? So one of the great rabbis sent a disciple to watch Shabtai Tzvi, spend the Shabbos with him. And he saw that in the morning Shabtai Tzvi wasn't meticulous, he wasn't careful to wash his hands in the morning like our sages say before he started doing other things. And he brought back the whole report. He said, look, he seems very learned. He knows this, he knows that. He's claiming this, he's claiming that. There was one thing, I don't know, he wasn't so careful with washing his hands in the morning when he woke up. And that sage said, no, and you tell everyone not to come close to him. A man on his level, if he's not careful with that, then something's wrong at the foundation. A lot of the sages were wondering in the beginning whether to join Shabtai Tzvi or not. It's very difficult sometimes to know when a person's making claims whether to join him or not. So a person has to know that just because the leaders are representing it as for God-fearingness doesn't mean it's legitimate. And a person should look to the sages and hear what they say directly. We had a guy this week who went up to Har HaBayis. A guy I know went up to Har HaBayis, went up to the Temple Mount. It was a special day in his life, so he got authorization, he got people to come with him, he went to Mikveh, and he's going to the Temple Mount. So I was standing next to him when he met the son of the chief rabbi, Rav Ram Shapiro's son. And he told him he's on his way to the Temple Mount. So Rabbi Shapiro's son asked him, did you ask a rabbi? So he said, I asked the rabbi, and I heard that the chief rabbi, Rabbi Avram Shapiro, your father, said that whoever goes up has who to rely on, that it's a legitimate opinion. So his son asked him, what do you mean you heard my father said that? Did you hear it from my father? Did you verify? So the guy said, I didn't hear it from your father, but I heard that's what he says.
You mean the Shemayim?
So he said, he told him, you're going to go do something which, if you're wrong on, you're chayv kares. You're going to get cut off, you're going to die young, your children are going to die young. For generations to come, you're going to do this based upon someone saying that that's what my father said? That's how you verify halacha? So people have to know that in every instance, you have to verify what the truth is. You have to verify if a person's arguing for really legitimate claims or not, and did the rabbis really endorse him or not. There's a person here in Israel now who's posting pictures of him with all the great rabbis, and it turns out that he's Christian. He's coming to all the institutions and trying to get their backing. It's a serious problem. And he's really a missionary. But he has pictures with a lot of rabbis. So don't believe pictures and don't believe people's claims. You have to verify things. Korach is coming on the scene. He has holy claims. But really, he was off. The people who were with him, they were called Anshei Shem, men of name. What kind of name did they have? The simple understanding is they were famous men. They were the leaders. Another understanding says they had a Shem Ra. Anshei Shem, they had a name. Yeah, they had a name for being bad people. People's names can say something. We have different crowns. And we say Keter Shem Tov, the crown of a good name goes above everything. So it's true, Keter Torah goes above everything. There are different aspects where different things go above everything. But a person has to value a person's good name. And something to work on. A person has to be careful what people say about him, not just what he's doing in truth. The congregation is arguing with Moshe, and Moshe begs them, let's see tomorrow. He pushes them off, and that's a rule in life. Push off. People make the biggest mistake in haste. The Pasuk says in Mishlei, Nachlam Vohelet Barishona, if you try to get something in a rush, you buy real estate in a rush, V'achita lo tvorach, and then there won't be a blessing. Whenever you try to be rushed into a deal, you should know chances are you're losing. It's very rare that you can make money and gain something and you have to be rushed. Most good things you have to think about. That doesn't mean you can't jump on a deal. Sometimes you should jump on a deal. But more often than not, when people jump, they make mistakes. And sometimes the mistakes are their life. So Moshe Rabbeinu is giving Korach a second chance. He's saying, let's talk tomorrow. Let's wait. Our greatest leaders made their mistakes in haste. Moshe's with the rock. Tells Aaron, hit the rock, hit it again. You do things in haste. So, Adam Rishon, right? If he would have waited a little longer, the whole world would have looked differently. King Saul, Shaul HaMelech, if he would have waited a little bit longer, but he was in a rush, people were pressuring him. So Moshe is giving Korach and doesn't give him a second chance. Tells him, let's see tomorrow. Aaron did the same thing. When the Jews came to do the Egel, he said, tomorrow morning we'll have a party for Hashem. Let's see tomorrow. Pushing them off. Very often people could save themselves big fights and sometimes even divorce. If they'll only push off conversation. I tell people when they're on the verge of getting married, you see there's a fight brewing between you and your wife, pull out. You feel like if you're going to pull out, you're gonna hurt more than you're going to do well, say you have to go to the bathroom. It's always legitimate to go to the bathroom. You're always allowed to go to the bathroom. Nothing wrong. So if that's the only way you can pull out, go to the bathroom. Sit in the bathroom for a half hour. You calm down, she'll calm down. Then go out and talk. If you have no other way of pulling out, so at least push it off that way. Moshe is telling Korach and Dathan and Aviram, let's see tomorrow. The next day, Moshe sends word to Dathan and Aviram, and from here we learn that a Bezdin that has people arguing against them disrespectfully, they're going to be punished by the court. But first we try to dissuade them. First we try to appease them. So we send a messenger, and they scorn the messenger. And the messenger comes back and tells Moshe, look, they're making fun. They don't want to come. They mock you and your court. And from here we learn that a messenger that's sent by the court is allowed to report back to the court. It's not considered Lashon Hara. Otherwise you'd say, how could he say back bad things? You're not allowed to say Lashon Hara. From here we derive that he's allowed to report back to the Bezdin. Moshe Rabbeinu tells Hashem, I didn't even take from them one donkey, one chamor. You remember what animal was Moshe Rabbeinu riding when he came to Egypt with his wife and two kids? A chamor, a donkey. What animal is Mashiach going to be riding on when he's going to come?
But then they say that's just a figure of speech to show that he's going to be like a poor guy.
Right. That's a figure of speech that he's going to be poor. We say he's going to be ani rochev al chamor, a poor man riding on a donkey. So that's to say that Mashiach is going to be like Moshe Rabbeinu, coming on a donkey. He's going to be poor. Moshe Rabbeinu is saying, I didn't even take the animal that only poor people take.
It was his own donkey.
It was his own donkey. Moshe says, you know, I've been in service for these people for a long time now. And I should have taken wages. I should have said, at least fund my donkey. I'm traveling from Midian here. You should at least fund my transportation. Moshe says, I didn't even take that. I didn't take a thing from them. I didn't even take one donkey. Moshe Rabbeinu was poor. Everyone else is leaving Egypt with great wealth. And Moshe Rabbeinu doesn't have that. He's poor. Moshe Rabbeinu had the trait of histapkut. He was happy with what he had. It's a trait that society today is working to wear down. The economy is based on the fact that we will not have this trait. You will buy more. You make a good product, you advertise well, you'll get people to buy it. Do they need it? Don't they need it? That's irrelevant. You can get people to buy. My father-in-law always says, there's a store called Amazing Savings, where when you walk into the store, you can find things very cheaply. You can find amazing deals. But you walk into the store, you don't need anything that's in the store. So you end up buying things because they're very, very cheap. They're at a great rate. You can buy a phone for $2. Great. You got a new phone. Did you need a new phone? You didn't need that phone. So did you save or did you lose? So my father-in-law always says, it's not amazing savings, it's amazing spending. You walk in there, you see all these deals. You say, it makes sense to buy. When are you going to find the phone for $2? But you didn't need the phone. You had enough phones in the house. What are you going to do with that phone? People don't think that way. So Moshe Rabbeinu had the trait of his tafkut. He had enough. He was happy with what he had. You walk into the great Talmidei Chachamim's homes. You walk into Rav Shlomo Zalman's home. You see, there's almost nothing there. There's a table. There's a lamp. There are the sfarim he needs, and that's it. You walk into the average person's home today, there isn't enough room on the shelves to house the things that he has. People have more and more and more. Who needs it? Avraham Avinu also had that trait. When he wins the war, so he's told by the king of Sodom, he says, I'll give you, you take the people, I'll give you the wealth. And Avraham says, I don't want anything. I don't want from a string to a shoelace. I don't want anything. I don't need anything of yours. Shmuel also had that trait. When Shmuel was about to give over the rulership to King Saul, they said, tell me, did I ever take anything from you? Did I take a donkey? Did I take an ox? I never took anything. The person is supposed to try and develop that trait. Korach and his men are placing doubt in Moshe Rabbeinu's prophecy. And this isn't the first time we're encountering that. Miriam and Aaron, when they discuss Moshe, they're discussing, how did Moshe leave his wife? How come he's better than us? We're prophets, we never left our spouses. Why did Moshe leave his spouse? Why isn't he living with her like husband and wife? The Meraglim, we just had, they're coming back. Moshe says, we'll go in, we'll conquer it. And they're saying, no, we can't do it. It's not going to work. Was Caliph tell him, if Moshe says to climb to the sky, we climb to the sky. Whatever he says goes. And they say no. And the Jewish people say no. And now we reach a point where Korach and his men are saying, who says you're supposed to be boss? Who says Aaron's supposed to be boss? As a result, God tells Moshe, "V'lo yeche Korach v'chadato." There will never be like Korach and his men. According to one understanding, this is a commandment that one should not disagree with the tradition we have from Moshe. There should never be anyone like Korach and his men. Where's this all coming from? Another argument like Korach, another person who will come and contest Moshe's prophecy.
Or at that point, any leader of Israel?
No. It's unclear whether there's an avera to rebel against the king. The king is allowed to kill anyone who rebels, but it's unclear whether it's forbidden to rebel. You could rebel and he might kill you. But that doesn't mean you're forbidden to rebel. You might have the right to rebel, and he might have the right to kill whoever rebels. That doesn't mean it's forbidden to rebel. Maybe you shouldn't risk your life.
Switch. I mean, you get electrocuted, but I mean, you're allowed to hit it if you want. I mean,
no, it's very important if we present it that way, which seems to be the way the Rambam presents it, because that gives a foundation for the principle that's reinstated in the Bill of Rights. That we're assuming that if the leadership is going to be unjust, the people will rebel. And when we read the Torah, we see that the Torah presents us with a monarchy. We'll have a king. Does the Torah give us any way out of this king? What happens if the king is unjust? What happens if he's unfair? So if you say it's forbidden to rebel against the king, then you're saying you're stuck. The Torah states there's a monarchy, end of the story. If you say the Torah didn't say you're stuck, the Torah says you're supposed to honor the king, respect the king, etc. Now, if you rebel, the king is allowed to kill you. But maybe if the king is so unjust, you'll be able to put together a just rebellion and you will rebel and succeed and you did nothing wrong. That's where the question comes in. That maybe there is legitimacy to rebellion. Halachic legitimacy.
How about that?
There is a possibility.
The Rambam presents it that if one rebels, the king has permission to kill him. That's how the Rambam presents it. The Rambam seems to indicate that that there's no prohibition against rebelling. But there's just the risk that a person might get killed. So you'll tell me, should one risk his life? One is not supposed to risk his life. But on the other hand, there are times when one is permitted to risk his life. Meaning we say, one shouldn't walk under a tree that's leaning. It might fall on him. One shouldn't climb an unsteady ladder. One shouldn't go into a ship that's not been checked and isn't fit for the seas. One shouldn't cross a bridge that isn't clear that the bridge could stand his weight. But is it forbidden for him to do all these things? No. It's not wise. He shouldn't do it. But that doesn't mean it's forbidden. We're supposed to watch our lives. We're supposed to do the maximum to keep them. But there's an element of risk which we're entitled to take, but we're recommended not to take. And rebelling might fall under those guidelines.
So what's the law that you're supposed to respect the leader of our time? I mean,
okay.
I'm trying to find it here.
Yeah. One should place a king over.
Right, you've got to respect your leader.
I'll tell you the truth.
The fact that he got up there says a lot, and that he was put there by the people.
It's a good question.
Like for example, like Sharon. And we put him there, but yet.
So you're assuming that a person who's prime minister is equal to a person who's a king, which isn't a very clear assumption
not
at all.
Not necessarily, okay, but I'm saying, no, it says leader. It doesn't say king, it says leader.
And as far as, that's for a different discussion. It's a long discussion. You want next Thursday, we'll have time. Bring up the point. We'll try to work it up. Huh?
Next Thursday?
Hopefully, yeah. This Thursday is just make up for Wednesday.
How was the wedding?
Hashem, yeah. Baruch Hashem. So Korach and his men, they're in till the end. And On Ben Pelet, who we know was really, his real name was Nemuel, he was Dasan and Aviram's brother, he wants to get out. And he has a smart wife, yeah. His wife tells him, what difference does it make? Under Moshe, you're not the leader. Under Korach, you're not the leader. Why join this fight? So she's right, and he tells her, yeah, but I'm embarrassed. How will I get out of it? So she's a smart wife. She says, you go to sleep, I'll take care of things. And she sits at the entrance of the tent, and she starts combing her hair. And everyone else, everyone that comes to call him sees that she's there, and she says, he's not in. Sorry. So they leave, and they end up continuing the fight without him, and this is how he gets out. You see, he chickened out, but he made it. So sometimes even a chicken can make it. He was embarrassed. He didn't look them in the eye and say, no, I'm not joining you. But that still saved his life. Sometimes people say, what will I do? So chicken out. Don't answer the phone. Don't be there. I sometimes tell guys, people tell me, I can't respect my father. Every time he calls, he yells at me. He starts cursing me out. He tells me I shouldn't be in yeshiva, X, Y, Z. All kinds of things. So I tell him, okay, so who said you have to answer the phone? If you're not going to answer him respectfully, so don't answer the phone. So that's not the ideal. So you chickened out. That's true. But at the end of the day, you're better off doing that than answering him disrespectfully. A parent is not supposed to curse out his kid. But if a parent curses out his kid, the kid's not allowed to curse him back. So if he's not going to be able to live up to it, better don't answer the phone. Sometimes that's the best option. So On Ben Pelet couldn't live up to his job. He couldn't look them in the eye and say, you guys are wrong. But at least he saved his life. He chickened out. His wife saved his life, right? Smart wife. And he was smart for listening to her. So we see that the neighbors here got in trouble. Korach is on the same side that Dasan and Aviram are. They're all neighbors. And here we have the concept, Oy l'rasha v'oy l'shcheino. Woe to the Russia and woe to his neighbor. People have to be careful to choose a place where they have good neighbors. I have a friend who, before he bought his house, every house he looked into who the neighbors are. So you have no guarantee that they'll remain your neighbors, but neighbors are worth a lot. Tov shachen karov ma'achachok. The pasuk says in Mishlei, better a neighbor who you're close to than a brother who you're distant from.
Did you see the duplex? The movie? It's a comedy with those two Jews.
No.
Sorry, Rob. Because you brought this issue up. It's all about the neighbors. It's so funny.
So a good neighbor is an asset. And a bad neighbor detracts from the person himself. And we see here that Korach's neighbors, because they were his neighbors, he pulled them down with him. The next morning, the people come and they tell Moshe, Tema mitem etam Hashem, you caused God's people to be destroyed. What's the claim? So on the simple level, they didn't learn their lesson.
It was very clear.
It sounds like almost they were his neighbors, the 250, right?
We say that the neighbors were Dasan and Aviram, the tribe of Reuven.
Right, but they were situated next to him, right? Because
right.
Of the way that
the camp was set up, yeah.
So it almost sounds like through no fault, through the 250, through no fault of their own, only, you can say everything's from Hashem, but their proximity to just their living situation, their geographical proximity to Korach, they're kind of gone. Definitely fail in a way, I guess, if you want to say.
A few things. Firstly, just because the tribe is camped there, doesn't mean that a person has to camp there. I'm sure that within the tribe, you could move your tent somewhere within the camp. And even if that's not so, I don't know, I wasn't there, and I don't know of a source about whether within the tribes, the way the tents were set up. We're not saying that a person doesn't have situations in life where that's how he's set up. You're sitting on a bus, sometimes that's the guy who sits next to you. So you could stand up and walk away, and you could not. A guy sits next to you and opens up a magazine with unclean pictures. So your responsibility is to get up and walk away. A person gets on a plane. So sometimes the guy sitting next to him is going to turn on the TV and going to watch all kinds of things. Now, ideally, a person should walk away, try to get a different seat. First, he should recognize that it's detracting from him. You can't say he's in his and I'm in mine. If that's who your neighbor is, you're losing. And if a person has a neighbor, we once moved into an apartment where when we moved in, it seemed like there was a brothel on the top floor. So I was fuming. I thought told my wife, I don't care what we're going to have to pay, we're leaving the apartment. And the problem is that that how could I let someone else enter such an apartment? I was fuming that the landlord didn't tell me, the tenants didn't tell me. No one told me. I spoke to the neighbors. No one told me.
That's true.
I don't know if it was true. I know that the apartment where we had reason to suspect that's what was going on, the tenant switched within like 2-3 weeks after we moved in. So afterwards, it definitely wasn't true. It seems like it was probably not true, but it wasn't clear. There was a lot of weird things going on at all hours of the night. Guys, girls, I don't know. And I told my wife, I'm not even sure if we should... It was after we had moved in. We were there about a week, and suddenly I realized what was going on. So I told her, there's no way we're staying here. If it means that we're going to get fined on the contract, I don't know how much, we don't have a choice. There's no way we could stay here. So you could say, what do you care? They're in their house, you're in your house. Doesn't work that way. And the bigger the rasha, the more you have to make sure to distance yourself from it. So you're saying, did they have a choice? Didn't they have a choice? I don't know. I'm sure that there were ways of getting out of it. There were still people who had...
But you know what they say, trouble follows trouble. Daram and Aviram, we have a tradition, they were trouble.
Dasan and Aviram, right. They were trouble. But we see that there were people from the tribe of Reuven who wouldn't necessarily have been trouble. And people have noticed in general when they choose a college, when they choose a roommate, it's important to see who the neighbors are. The people you're around are going to have an effect on who you are. So the next day the people come with claims, you caused the nation of God to die. On the simple level, they just didn't learn their lesson. On the deeper level, it seems like the Gemara understands that the people's claims, the people came with a claim, they said, you could have forgiven them. You, Moshe, didn't forgive them, which was true. Moshe did not forgive them. Moshe asked Hashem, he said, don't even accept their part in the morning sacrifice that's supposed to represent all of the Jewish people. Don't accept it. We just said, Moshe Rabbeinu told them, he said, either the ground will swallow them up or I'm a liar. If they drop dead, I'm a liar. Special miracle has to happen here. So we see Moshe had no intention of forgiving them at this point. The people walking with a claim, you caused God's nation to die. There's a level when a person tries to ruin the hierarchy and tries to ruin social order. There's a point where we try to dissuade him, and there's a point where we say we got to get rid of him. There's no room for forgiveness anymore. That depends on at which state. And they had reached the point where Moshe said, that's it. At this point, they're going to die. End of story. And they're going to die in a natural death.
And how come his infants, babies, everything?
So let's get there in just a second. Let's finish this point, and then we'll get back to that. They come with a claim, you caused God's nation to die, and a plague hits the people. People start dropping dead. Moshe quickly tells Aaron, go out with the pen, with the ketores, and that'll stop the Malach HaMavis. Our sages say that it says Moshe, Aaron came back to Moshe, and the plague stopped. So our sages say that Aaron met up with the Malach HaMavis, the angel of death, and he had the ketores. Now, why did he have the ketores? Because when Moshe was up in heaven, each angel gave him a gift. The angel of death gave him a gift. He told him, I'll give you a secret. When there's a plague, you want to stop me? Do the ketores, that'll stop me. So now it was time to use that secret. So now Aaron comes up to the angel of death with the frying pan, with the special pan, with the ketores. So the angel of death stops in his path. And he tells Aaron, get out of my way. So Aaron says, no, you got to stop. So the angel of death says, look, I've been sent by God, and you've been sent by Moshe. So I should listen to God, and you should get out of my way. So Aaron told the angel of death, he said, Moshe doesn't send me to do anything unless God said so. So you stop and come with me. So they both went to Moshe. That's what the Medrash says. So they both went to Moshe, and Moshe verified it. God had told them to do this, and that's why he had sent Aaron and the angel, the plague had to stop. That's why the verse says, Aaron took the frying pan and he brought it back to Moshe, and then the plague stopped. What was he bringing back to Moshe? He was taking the angel of death and saying, hey, let's ask Moshe. He didn't send me unless God said so.
Someone went to God and said, Hashem, you told me to.
God sent a cure, so to speak, the ketores. The Jewish people thought
ketores
is a special combination of different spices that are burnt together to give a special sense, which God says finds favor in His eyes.
Better known as the incense offering.
It's known as the incense offering, right. So God sent the cure, the ktoris. The day before, how did these 250 men die? They had a frying pan with the ktoris, and they weren't fit for it, so they dropped dead. So the same ktoris can kill, and the same ktoris could save people's lives. Our sages say that the Jews were saying that ktoris is dangerous. Why do we have to deal with it? It kills people. And Hashem said, I'll show them that it saves people's lives. It's not the ktoris that kills. It seems like this happened a few times when the Jews were in the desert. They left Egypt and they said, God kills, God maims, God destroys. 10 plagues we just saw, a whole year's worth of God's destroying the Egyptians. And then it ends off with the firstborns dying. What kind of God are we under? So what's the first thing God does when we enter the desert? They encounter water that's so bitter no one can drink. They're on the verge of dying. They have nothing. What are they going to do? God makes the water be tasty. And God says, I am Hashem, your healer. Hashem is saying, don't think I only punish. All the punishments you saw in Egypt, you won't have. I promise you. Keep the Torah and they won't come to you. I am Hashem, your healer. They see the staff. They see the staff do all kinds of bad things. So again, God sends them with the staff to bring out the water to save their lives. And here they see the ktoris. They come with complaints. The ktoris is causing people to die. So God chose them. The ktoris is what saves people's lives. Very often we look at external factors and we say, this person died, he didn't get good medical treatment. This person died, they didn't get the medicine there on time. So on the one hand, it's true. We have to do hishtadlut. We have to do our best to keep people alive and to save our own lives. Lehishtadel means to try. We have to do our hishtadlut. We have to try. But at the end of the day, we have to know that there is someone running the show up in heavens. We say, Hakol bidei shamayim chutz meirat shamayim. Everything's in the hands of heavens, other than being a God-fearing person. So a person once came to one of the rabbis of Brisk, I think it was, and the rabbi asked him, how you doing? So he said, thank God, good, the family's healthy. So he said, but how are you doing? So he said, thank God, good, the business is doing well. So he said, how are you doing? So the guy's wondering, what does he want from me? If the business is doing well, my family is healthy, what else is there? So he asked him, what does the rabbi want? So he said, look, your health, that's not in your hands. God made you healthy. Your wealth, that's not in your hands. God made you wealthy. I'm asking how you're doing. That's how God-fearing are you. How are you doing? That's what's in your hands. Are you a God-fearing person or not? Everything else God controls. We do our best, but it's not in our hands at the end of the day. There was a lack of faith here. They said, Moshe, you're making things up. And we find that when there's a lack of faith, God says, I'll intervene to put faith back. It's very difficult to restore faith. Very difficult. When a husband and wife have a problem that he doesn't trust her, so the Torah gives us a special remedy. God says, I'll intervene. I'll have my name erased and I'll tell the husband, forget it. It's over. I proved it. I was here. God says, my name is erased into the water she drinks. If she came out clean, forget it. She's clean. Live with her from now on like a husband and wife. Love her. Don't think of all the doubts you had beforehand. That's it. I've proved it. The people are coming and they're doubting Moshe and God intervenes. We have special miracles happening on this day. We have a tradition that God created certain exceptions to nature on twilight of the Friday. Ordinarily there's nature. But God created 10 things that would be an exception to nature. One of them was the opening of the earth. That special mouth that the earth opened up, swallowed up Korach and closed its mouth. That was an exception to nature. You could have an earthquake, the ground could open up. For the ground to open up exactly where they're all standing, close up right over them, that was something God created at twilight of the sixth day on Friday afternoon.
And why did the incense die?
We'll get to that in a second. So, we have to try not to break faith. People have to know that a breach of faith is something that's very, very difficult, almost impossible to make up. And when a person has faith, one of the worst things he could do is break it. We know that God's signature, there was once a letter that was found by the great sages, and it was signed Emes. And from here our sages derived, they said that letter was God-given. God sent down that letter. A note came down from heaven. They were discussing something, a note came down. They looked at it, the answer was written, signed Emes. And our sages said, God gave us that letter, And he signed his name Emes. That's God's signature. Emes is truth. Only God is really truthful, but we all have to aspire to be truthful. Emes is the letters Aleph, Mem, Taf. Aleph is the first letter, Taf is the last letter, Mem is the middle letter, right? That's the letters of the alphabet. That's God's signature. God is all-encompassing, and His truth is all-encompassing. One of the traits a person has to develop is zehirut, to be careful. But midarkei zehirut, one of the things about being careful is not to be careful about being careful. And sometimes people are so careful, they're extra careful. A person has to be careful not to be too careful. There's a limit to how careful a person should be. People sometimes enter marriage and they keep checking up. And a person could check up before he gets married. But after he gets married, that's it. You have to have faith. You have to put all your eggs in that basket and make it grow. Does that mean that there aren't people who cheat on their spouses? It happens. But you can't build a home without faith. And the person has to live up to that faith. When the faith is broken over here, when Korach says, I don't believe you, Moshe. Moshe, you're taking everything for yourself. What does Moshe do? He falls on his face. He says, God, what can I do? You have to intervene. How am I going to tell him? What am I going to say? No. I'm not proud. I didn't take the honor for myself. When people tell you you're proud, when people say you're just doing this because you want, what are you going to say? No, I'm not proud. I'm a humble person. You can't say that about yourself. So Moshe falls on his face and says, God, what can I do? So God intervenes. Let's end with...
why did the kids die?
Oh, so we owe you that. Why did the kids die? This our sages say shows us the strength of machlokas. But ordinarily, kids aren't punished. But when there's a machlokas, when you light a fire, so then you have no control where the fire is going to go. People sometimes think, you know, I just did this. Why did it continue to that? Sometimes a guy pushes his friend. So the guy turns back and socks him in the face. So he says, what do you mean? I just pushed you. You could just push me back. No, you started a fight. You didn't just push me. You started a fight, you have no control where it'll end. People have to be careful not to start fights, because when it starts, you don't know where it'll end. You make fun of a person, you don't know where he'll get back at you. So he gets back to you and you say, well, that's ridiculous. What did I do? I just made a joke. You didn't just make a joke. You started a fight. When people start fights, they have no control where it'll end. And our sages say we derive from here. Korach's children died with him. The children, Korach's children, they said, in the last second they said, no, we want the tshuva. Moshe is telling the truth. And they were saved. But Korach and his men, Dasan and Aviram, and their wives and children, they went. Because when there's machlokas, it sweeps things with it. The Torah then tells us which special things the Kohanim have to get. And the Torah tells us, Barimchem et chelbo mimenu, when you take the good parts from it. And from here we derive that when one gives truma and meiser, one is supposed to give from the better part of the crops. You have a crop of grain, you could take from the lesser crops. Our sages say, no, the Torah is telling you, take from the better crops. You have wine, you have grapes, give from the wine. The wine is better. You have better wine, lesser wine, give from the better wine. I don't know if you could give from wine on grapes. I think that's too minim. I don't remember if you could get from wine on grapes. I think you could. It's a Mishnah, I don't remember. This concept applies to many things. We have many mitzvahs that the Torah tells us the first fruits you give to Hashem. The Torah tells us this about truma. The Torah tells us this about challah. The Torah, right, when you make dough, the first dough you give to the kohen. The Torah tells us bikurim, the first fruits you're supposed to give in honor of Hashem. The Torah tells us this about our firstborn. Our firstborn, we have to redeem, so to speak, from Hashem. Give Hashem money, so to speak, to redeem the firstborn. When we have things, we're supposed to honor Hashem with them, and that's supposed to set our focus in life. A person gets a new car, his first drive should be to go and do a mitzvah. Everything a person has, he should remember. He has it to serve his Creator, and he should try to get accustomed. At least the first use should be in honor of Hashem. There's a story about the Gerer Rebbe. The Rebbe by Gur, he had in his family a set of tefillin that they cherished, that was passed down from generation to generation, that was written by a very big tzaddik and with great care. And he'd only wear those tefillin when it was nearing Yom Kippur and Aser Simei Tshuva on special occasions. That's how honored these tefillin were. He himself didn't wear them every day, didn't dare wear them every day. And the grandchildren were already discussing which grandchild was on the highest level, who would get it. And then one day, a grandson came into his grandfather's study. He came into the Ger Rebbe's study, and he saw the tefillin were missing. So he turned to his grandfather and he asked, "Where are those special tefillin that we've had in our family for so long?" And his grandfather told him, he said, "A Jew came a few days ago, and he told me he has no tefillin. He says he doesn't even have tefillin to wear today, and he doesn't have tefillin to wear tomorrow. And he's moving on, and he doesn't have where to buy, and he doesn't have from what money to buy. So I gave him those tefillin."
Could have given the money.
So the grandson said, "But Grandpa, I don't understand. Give him the other tefillin you wear. Why'd you give him those tefillin?" So he said, "No. When you perform a mitzvah, you perform a mitzvah from the best stuff you have. Here I had a chance to perform a mitzvah to give a Jew tefillin. So I gave him the best tefillin I had. I gave him the tefillin that I had for generations." And I think that's a perspective we're supposed to develop regarding everything we do. Ben adam l'chaverov, be it to our friends. Usually guys, when they offer someone else a piece of cake, so they'll offer him the crust or the burnt part, or like it's always the lesser part. And when people give tzedakah, so also they try to do it in all kinds of ways. And the Torah teaches us that's supposed to be the other way around. We're always supposed to take the best and honor Hashem with that, honor the poor person with that. That's how we're supposed to serve our Creator. So, shkach.